live from the Cultural Hall, this is the Mormon News Report for the week of February 12th, 2018. We are your weekly dose of Mormonism.
With a dose of snark that is somber and, folks, let me just say this, sober in nature and where we podcast responsibly.
Folks, we encourage safe podcasting out there. Remember, the life that you save might be your own.
And just for everyone's, just so everyone's okay, it is a diet squirt. That is the beverage of choice tonight. We're really, Brian, listen, I can't do caffeine this late. And,
I was gonna say, not only is it non-caffeinated. So, you know, it's pre BYU policy shift friendly.
Yes.
But it's diet at that. No sugar. But you know what? I mean, in all honesty, Brant, I've got sparkling water here. Orange cream flavored.
Let me tell you something.
We're hitting it hard tonight.
Let me tell you something about that Walmart Clear American stuff. They didn't pay for this plug, but I'm going to tell you this. That Walmart Clear American sparkling flavored water is the best stuff ever. And we hit a point where I think I was buying about 20 bottles every couple of weeks because Ashley and I could not stop drinking it. Like, that gets the full Mormon News Report seal of approval. That stuff is awesome.
Okay, this is what I'm going to say. It is the best sparkling water for 50 cents that I've ever had.
That too. The price plays a big, big factor in that too.
Anyway, why don't we talk about our question that we threw out last week and we kind of got a little, I don't know, what's the word for it?
A little testy.
Testy's a good word.
So we were talking last week about a lot of the realignments that were going on, and specifically what was going on with Europe, and frankly, how Europe was not doing too well. So the question we threw out there was, with Uchtdorf as the chair of the missionary department, and now the primary contact for Europe and Europe East, do you think there's going to be any changes within the European missions or basically how things in Europe are going? What we're trying to say is this. Are we going to continue hemorrhaging from an LDS church perspective in Europe, or is the magic of the silver fox going to save the day? And Brian, it was interesting. I didn't think that there would be this much commentary on it, but a lot of people were a little defensive, I guess is the word.
I think it came down to the word hemorrhaging when it comes down to it. Nobody likes to hear. And I think a lot of it comes down to kind of this ex-Mormon trope that you hear thrown around online that the church is just crumbling from within, that it's bleeding its infrastructure. That's not how we intended it. I think there's a lot of defensiveness out there.
And I think what we're trying to do, at least through our podcast, is take a look at everything and not so much Mormon myth bust, but like just look at data and look at what's logistically out there and from credible people. So we talked about it before. Matt Martinich over at ldschurchgrowth.blogspot.com just crunches numbers like a machine. And he said this, he said, overall, no measurable LDS growth appear to occur in Europe during 2017. So this is on his website. This wasn't on our Facebook page. No growth appeared to occur in Europe during 2017. Low member missionary participation, secularism, nominal religious ties to traditional Christian denominations, challenges assimilating immigrant and refugee converts into congregations, and low self-sufficiency in European nations staffing their full-time missionary needs constitute significant barriers towards real growth. Nevertheless, reports from local members and recently returned missionaries indicate improvements in sacrament meeting attendance during the past several years for many congregations in some European countries, such as Germany. So there's some positives there, but it's also not very good. And I didn't include this in the write-up that I did there, but one thing that he did talk about was there are some places where they just haven't seen any converts at all. And that's something that is a bit of a concern if you're thinking about just the natural life cycle of LDS people. And I'm talking like people passing away and not having anybody, not having as many children and not having any converts to boost up those ward numbers.
Yeah. And I mean, the bottom line is that the next generation growing up in Europe is just less interested in religious engagement. It's, you know, and I think that that's where we need to clarify what we intended by this question, because this isn't a question that's solely directed at Mormonism. It is for us because that's what we're interested in. That's our topic on this show. But this is a general religious trend across the board, whether it's, you know, any number of Protestant churches, whether it's a Catholic church, whether it's Mormonism, whether it's even Islam is in Europe, the next generation growing up just aren't that interested in religious engagement. So
hemorrhaging, I would just say that
you're stagnation.
Stagnant. Yeah, it's completely stagnant. Yeah.
And so maybe that word was a little bit clickbaity. And I apologize for that. But, you know, definitely stagnant growth. Next generation isn't attending church as much. They don't consider themselves to be fully engaged, and it is concerning. Like you said, there's some places that just haven't had a single convert in an entire year. And I think, Brant, before we move on, because I mean, I know that we just want to get a little quick hit on this, but one of the things that we tend to do as Mormons is we tend to be very number focused, whether it's numbers of converts per mission, whether it's the number of overall membership. It's like every general conference that we have, when they read the conference report and report on the numbers, we're always wanting a boost in those numbers. And somehow we equate it with the growth of the church numerically with our truthfulness, right? Like we're more true, we're more, I don't know, we have more vitality if we're growing in spades. And I would challenge our listeners to stop looking at it from that perspective, that the growth of church membership numbers is not related whatsoever to the truthfulness of the gospel.
But that swings both ways, though. I mean, and I think that's where you're going with it, but it swings both ways. I think that that's part of the problem that we've encountered, at least from the faithful LDS side, where you and I are, is a lot of us can remember some of those statistics that were being thrown out. I want to say it was in the 1980s, where a researcher said that, you know, within, I don't remember how many years, but the LDS church was going to be the largest growing, the largest.
Yeah, something like 16 billion members or some off the wall number like that.
And at the same time, so there's that side where yeah, definitely we need to hold off a little bit on that. But there's that other side where people are looking at the lower number of missionaries and what's going on in Europe, saying, ah, see, this is the decline of the LDS church. But Brian, I don't know if we're ever going to get to that point where we could just say, like, these are numbers are numbers, and it is what it is, because every side is going to want to use it for however they use it. And listen, I'm with you. I'm more fascinated in looking at the numbers and saying, okay, what trends are we seeing? What's going on here? What is it within Africa that's really blossoming with LDS people? Why is it not working in Europe? Why is it not working necessarily in my former mission, which is South Korea? I'm more interested in that than, see, this proves that the LDS church is on the decline, or this proves that the LDS church is on the ascent. I don't really care that much.
Yeah, imagine that. People using numbers to bolster their own polemic biases. That never happens.
Yeah, let's not get crazy here. Let's not get crazy. Brian, we did get a voicemail this week, but the voicemail touched on a few different topics that we didn't hit with the question of the week, but topics that we had discussed. So let's listen to this voicemail.
Hey guys, it's Andrew from Kansas City once again. I have a thought on three of the news topics that were talked about this week. The first one involves the Jew and the former Nazi who met, fell in love, and that news story was run on LDS Living. My thought to that is this. Would LDS Living be willing to run some of the stories we might find in the book Moroni and the Swastika? That'd be something interesting to chew on. Also, with Jeremy Guthrie becoming a mission president, it'll be nice if Jeremy Guthrie eventually becomes a general authority. Hey, we'll actually have someone who, a general authority who actually will have played for the for a Major League Baseball team. If you remember back in the 80s, there was a general authority by the name of Paul H. Dunn who told a lot of stories, including stories where he talked about playing for the St. Louis Cardinals, but many of those stories ended up not being true, especially and including the ones where he played for professional baseball. All right, guys, that's my take. See ya.
All right, Brian. Oh,
Paul H. Dunn. You gotta love bringing up Paul H. Dunn, you know, because, I mean, that he, what is it, faith, his faith-promoting stories were... The treasure of many.
But you know what, though? Paul H. Dunn has actually seen a bit of a revival a little bit. And I would actually credit a lot of that with people like Greg Prince, who spent a lot of time talking with him for his David O. McKay biography. And I think that if based on some of the things that I've seen Paul H. Dunn write recently or say recently in interviews, I think that if he could, he would go back and not say what he said. Now, granted, that's playing the result, but I don't know. That is interesting. We might actually have our first official MLB player who is a general authority if Jeremy Guthrie ever becomes a general authority. But I got to know, what are your thoughts on, did you read the book Moroni and the Swastika by?
I didn't. I'm aware of the book, but I didn't. I think that there's, from what I understand, I believe that there's some pretty challenging stories in there that would probably not be LDS Living type material, because there's a lot of stuff in there. From what I understand, again, I haven't read it, but from what I understand, and correct me if I'm wrong, you guys can write in and holler at me. From what I understand, the LDS church was a little bit more, I don't want to say sympathetic, but we weren't exactly the heroes during the European conflict with this. We weren't exactly standing up for strong principles. We were more kind of accommodating, I guess. Accommodating is probably the best word for it.
Yeah. And it's a hard book, but I think it's an important book to read. And I think it adds to the complexity of what was going on at that time. I mean, obviously it's very easy to look at the Nazi regime now and say, yeah, boy, bad stuff was going on.
Right.
But it's interesting. If you begin to read contemporary accounts at the time, there was, I don't know, there, it's the same reason why you start hearing stuff like Henry Ford was sympathetic to Nazis,
you know, and that he was anti-Semitic. Right. Yep. Exactly.
Anyways, so yeah, I think it's a very interesting book. It's historically based. I want to say it was put out by University of Oklahoma. So it was put out by a university press, but it's not an easy read. Okay, should we get into the news?
Yeah, let's get into the news this week.
All right, so
it wasn't a terrible week.
No,
there's some tough stories, but overall, it wasn't like oh my heck, look at what's going on this week. It's like, you know, something coming on the feed every hour or anything like that.
I would say that. I would say we have two major stories that are a little more complex and a bunch of smaller ones that are just like, oh, that's nice. Okay.
So, in other words, the internet paced itself well this week, and folks who write in newspapers and, you know, articles and put out this stuff, you know, we just want to thank you for pacing yourselves a little bit better this week. If you can keep up that pace, then maybe we can, you know, keep our show at a reasonable amount of time instead of just flooding us with all this stuff.
Mm-hmm. That's and the less that I got to sit there and go, okay, how are we going to talk about this? Okay, so let's go to the first one. The first one is from NPR's All Things Considered, a great show if you guys listen to it. And they talked with Dan Reynolds and talked with him a little bit about his film Believer that he's got coming out. And he said something interesting on the backlash that he's received from the film. He said, "I spent a lifetime trying not to offend people. That's one thing that Mormons are really good at, is smiling and shaking your hand and doing everything they can to not offend you. And I've gotten to this point in life where I don't want to live that way anymore. At the end of the day, there are going to be people who look at this, the movie that is, and say, you're not Mormon enough. And then there are going to be people on the other side that are going to say, you're not coming down hard enough on the Mormon church, and you should leave. So I'm kind of writing this middle ground that I know is going to be offensive to people. All I can do is just be myself and follow my heart, and this is my path." Brian, I like that. And I think that, not that I think that you're doing good work if you're straddling that line between people saying you're being too hard and people saying you're being too nice, but I think that shows that you're trying to go down a road of objectivity, because both of those camps, you're never going to please all of them, is what I'm saying.
I don't know, Brant, because thou were neither hot nor cold, then I'm going to spew you out of my mouth or something like that.
Something.
Something spewing. I don't know, but no, on a serious note, Brad, I think that I think that he couldn't have said it better, and I think that it's really where you and I sit as well. We're not conservative Orthodox enough to make that side happy. We're also not perhaps liberal enough or ex-Mormon enough to make that side happy. So we kind of sit here in this middle awkward middle ground where the fence post is quite frankly chafing me.
I've always thought of us kind of like, kind of like medicine. We're not going to taste that good, but it's what you need. But we're not
darn good for you, folks.
Yeah. All right. So speaking of, I don't know how to make this transition, so we'll just go with it. Jana Reese has done some really, really great work on the Next Mormon Survey. And this is something that people are getting a little bit concerned about. And I would just tell everyone at this point, you just hold on with all your critiques and criticisms of Jana and of this Next Mormon Survey, because from what I understand, and I will disclose this, Jana's a friend of the show. I've known Jana for a long time. Jana's trying really, really hard to do this correctly and do this objectively. So one of the difficulties when you're trying to do studies about LDS people is trying to find that very objective middle ground. So kind of like what Dan Reynolds was talking about, LDS people don't want to offend people. They also are very, very defensive of their own LDS position. And so Jana's tried to find a strong mix of people to look at, what are we going to see with millennial Mormons?
So kind of like Canadians, but more defensive.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, we're going to be
nice
to you, but
we're not going to say sorry.
Yeah. That's about it. We'll passive aggressively do something to you. Like, oh, isn't that precious? So here's what she said. And I thought this was great. She said, I wish church members would be more careful about judgment. I've mentioned here before that in addition to all the questions the next Mormon survey asked current Mormons about their belief and behaviors, we also surveyed former Mormons, including questions about why they left. Among millennials, I felt judged or misunderstood tied for the number one reason out of 29 possible reasons for leaving the church. It was third among Gen Xers and seventh for boomers and silent Mormons. There was a clear gender difference, too, among former Mormon women as a whole. Judgment ranked first. The good news from the next Mormon study, and there was plenty of good news, was that young adult Mormons are deeply spiritual and that they are interested in devotional practices that are often rigorous. They have high rates of daily prayer and sharing the gospel. They are strong believers in core Christian ideas. They do their home and visiting teaching. Women were especially vibrant ambassadors of their faith. Brian, I will say this. In addition to what she's saying here, if you want empirical evidence for that, go read the book Almost Christian. It was put out by Oxford University Press. And what they say in that book, they're looking at millennials and some of the trends they're seeing with religions, and specifically religions that are more universalist in nature. This is kind of how they describe it. They're more about like how you feel about your world around you. And what they found was that Mormon youth were actually very, very dedicated. And one of the reasons was because of what Jana said. We have a very vigorous way of showing our faith and living our faith. And we're very specific about things. And they said that that was a benefit. They actually highlighted LDS youth in this book. So Brian, the question for you is, why aren't you going to church, and when, and how long have you been sinning?
Well, it's only my third reason, because I'm a Gen Xer, not a not a millennial. I don't go to church because it's just boring, to be honest with you.
Okay.
And the seats aren't very comfortable. The snacks are awful, and the coffee is stale. It's terrible.
Listen, you need to go back to the soft seats in the overflow, like I'm.
You know, yeah, right, exactly. I sit in the couch in the foyer, the foyer. Let's make sure that we're not appropriating any cultural idioms here. It's funny, week after week, I sit there and I'm like, when's the coffee service coming? You know, and it just never happens. So I'm still giving it a shot, but it's just not happening. No, I wonder though, Brant, how much of this is just a generational clash in general. So I think millennials in general feel judged or misunderstood by the older generations, by the boomers and by the silent generations. Us Gen Xers, we just don't care, right? We're just like, eh. You know, you get me, you don't, I am what I am. But
well, and
not to quote Popeye. I don't want to quote Popeye here, because that's, you know, it's a copyright infringement. But with the millennials, I think that, you know, the fact is that the boomers and the silent generation are who still maintains like the ecclesiastical authority of our church, right? And they're the ones who are still setting the tone for our religion. And so even when they try to engage millennials, it's always the boomers and the silent generation leading that engagement with the millennials, right? So I do think that if millennials had more position of authority, were leading the tone more on their own, then I think that there would be less of a feeling of judgment and misunderstanding. So I think that a lot of this really does come down to generational differences.
So it's interesting you say that. So I work with the youth in my ward, and I'm in this weird position where I was born in 84. And so if I was a Gen Xer, I'd be like one of the last Gen Xers. I'm also one of the oldest.
I think we call you a baby Xer.
Millennials. Yeah, I don't know what I am. I am what I am, Brian. That's what I am. But it's interesting working with them. So I think because I'm a little bit younger, working with them is more interesting for me. And I found that they respond to me pretty well. But it's also a matter of, man, I got such an eclectic group of kids. And for me, it's like, hey, let's just welcome everybody. So I've got some really hardcore jocks, and I've got really hardcore Dungeons and Dragons players, and I've got really hardcore computer nerds who like love to talk to me about building a computer. And so granted, this is more on the male side of things, but it's almost like they are so used to having their own niches that they just hang out in there, and they don't really do well with the judgment side of things. But additionally to what you're saying, I'm also much more open to listening to the things that they want to do for activities or whatever. And I'm more willing to think about it and consider it and advise them versus someone who is maybe a baby boomer who goes, no, we can't do that. There's no way we can do that.
And wasn't the whole reason that we changed this curriculum, the youth curriculum, so that youth would take the lead more? yep. in this rather than having us old codgers sitting around lecturing at them for an hour while they're just picking their nails or checking their Facebook feed on their phones. But but is it working? That's the question. Is it really working, or are they still just sitting there picking at their nails and checking their Facebook feeds?
They're getting, I think the problem, they're getting better, at least from the ones that I've seen, but it's also very dependent on your personality. And so I will say one of the more inspiring things of working with the kids that I do is being able to see someone who's a little more introverted become a really, really good leader. And that's one of the more inspiring things that I see because that's an opportunity that they might not have at school. But what I'll also say is, one of my biggest pet peeves as a youth leader is listening to older youth leaders say, this would be good for the kids. Because I sit there and go, you're more concerned about what you think they should be doing instead of what they think they should be doing.
You know what we should talk to them more about is sexual purity, chastity, and marriage. Oh. I don't think that we hit on those topics enough.
So
right? Because those are things that millennials really want to talk about. Tell me about the importance of marriage, because I haven't quite gotten it pounded into my head enough.
Sounds like we got a little bit of steam to burn off in the deep cuts, Brian.
I think in the deep cuts, I might go into a little bit.
All right. So when we get into the deep cuts, remind me also to tell you about an interesting conversation that I was having with someone on talking to the youth about morality and sexuality. So
yeah, that's something that rarely gets brought up either.
Well, okay. But I think we can do it differently and I think we can do it better. And okay, we'll talk about it in the deep cuts. Let's keep going on. Sad news out of Virginia this week. Local LDS, it was an LDS stake president who passed away. He was president of the Washington, D.C. stake. He died after being overcome by carbon monoxide at his home in Montgomery County, Virginia. He was 61 years old. His name is James Baird. His wife has been released from the hospital, and she recovered fully. A spokesperson for the County Fire and Rescue Service said Baird was found near the furnace and that the boiler may have malfunctioned. Brian, the reason I'm including this story, as sad as it is, this was the Washington Post. The fact that this was mentioned in the Washington Post, I think that's a big deal.
Yeah. And we just want to make it clear to listeners that they did rule this as an accident.
Yep. It was totally an accident. And
before people, because you know how the rumor mill goes, a stake president, took his life and tried to take his wife's life. No, this was an accident. Stuff happens. We have fragile lives. Even if you're a stake president, we're still fragile human beings and things happen.
And additionally, it was featured in the Washington Post. Speaking of news stories that get featured, this one, when you sent me this story, it shocked me. The Deseret News covered the Josh and Lolly Weed story.
Okay, unbelievable.
That's not too surprising.
They got to them before John DeLynn did?
Well.
It's unbelievable.
The more important thing, Brian, they got to them before we did. I mean, what's going on there?
Well, we had Geraldine Hasselpool on, who's close inner circle friends with them. So I think that kind of counts.
That's true. That's true. Here's the thing that blew my mind. This was a 1,400-word article in the Deseret News with Josh and Lolly themselves talking about their story. Here's some of the things that they mentioned. This was, they talked about the original blog post where Josh came out as gay and being in a mixed orientation marriage. And they said the 7,000-word blog post outlining, I'm sorry. This is talking about their divorce, not the original post. This is talking about their divorce. The 7,000-word blog post outlining the reasons for their divorce has been read more than 400,000 times and was shared more than 50,000 times on Facebook, according to Josh and Lolly Weed.
That's viral.
That is like the definition of viral, right? So here's what Lolly said. As we started making mental shifts, that really did affect our relationship. You are no longer a broken straight person, but you are gay. That's what you are. They also talked with Ty Mansfield, who's been doing a lot of work. I believe Ty is gay, isn't he, Brian?
Yeah, he is. I'm really glad that they talked to him, by the way.
Yeah, I am too. I thought it was a great piece. And Ty said he believes that Josh and Lolly Weed's story is important. And also, so is his. Though they may be currently on different trajectories. We need more stories, not less, he said, and we need more cultural stories of people following a number of paths. Stories are powerful. And Brian, I think that this kind of leads to this overarching theme that we've seen where there's not one way to mourn. There's not one way to be a Mormon. There's a lot of different ways. And I think what we're going to see as we continue to get more and more diverse as a church, and specifically as we continue to see more and more coverage, you're going to see a lot of different paths. I think the more important thing though, is this was covered by the Deseret News. And I was shocked at some of the stuff that they were writing about. And I was very, very, they deserve our props, because this was a great piece. And I think about some people in my life who read the Deseret News very faithfully, reading this, and I say, yes, this is the story that they need to read.
Well, and I agree that with Mansfield that we need more stories, not less, on this. I mean, wasn't that the whole point of Mormon and gay .org was to get these, to get multiple stories out there, which it seems like, I mean, I don't know, I don't want to criticize too much, but it seems like we kind of like put it up and populated it with content and be like, okay, we've got all the stories that we need. And now it's just out there. I want the weed story to be on there.
I do too. I have a feeling it probably won't be on there.
It probably won't.
But I'll say this. I see, I think the problem, and this leads to just a bigger thing that I personally have been working through, and not in a bad way. It's just a continual frustration of mine. I think the problem is it's a resource that's out there that people can use, but they're not using it. And I think about it along the same lines as the Gospel Topics essays. So I know when I was involved with the bishopric, when we have our, do you guys do Fifth Sunday lessons where it's the men and the women combined?
Yeah, the combined lessons where it's usually.
So I was pushing for a long time myself.
I was going to say something really mean about what topics are usually covered, but I'll just. I don't want to get too, down into the ditches.
No, that's the problem that we had was the topics that we covered. It felt like we were doing the same ones every single month. Okay, we'll do another topic on, I don't know, we'll bring in LDS Family Services. It's not bad, but it's another one that we've done.
I wish that we would do that, bring in LDS Family Services. Instead, it's...
Well, but
it's personal morality stuff, and
See, ours are different. Ours are more. We've done things on we've done so many on emergency preparedness. But we were lobbying very hard for the bishop to use that Fifth Sunday to talk about the Gospel Topics essays because they're out there. I don't know if people know they're out there. There are resources out there, and they could be used a lot more. And that's the same thing when it comes to the Mormon and gay website. Is it's a resource that's out there, and I'm thinking for bishops or for someone who is gay and is struggling with their relationship with the LDS church, if you're a youth leader and you have a youth who's gay, it's out there. I don't know if people know it's out there, and I don't know if it's being pushed enough that, guys, you should go visit this. Like, I would love, and I'm speaking from a young men's perspective, right? I would love for a state young men's presidency to get all the different ward young men's presidencies together and say, you most likely have a boy or will have a boy who is gay. You should know about this resource and website. Here are some things that you can do to make sure that it is a positive experience. You know what I mean? And I just,
yeah, I know what you mean. You want to hear my Debbie Downer hot take on this?
Yeah.
All right. So we at least put the Gospel Topics essays up on the Gospel Library app. I mean, you got to do a little bit of digging for it, but if you scroll down to the history section, then you down in the bottom of the history section, you're going to find Gospel Topics essays. We haven't even done that with MormonandGay.org. And until we get it on our Gospel Library app as its own little section of, LGBT, Q issues or whatever, then I don't think that we're really taking it seriously. I think that we're just pandering with it. I think that we just have it out there so that we can say that we have it out there. Okay. I don't think we're being insincere, right? I don't think the church was insincere when they put it out or that the brethren who helped put this together were insincere at all about doing it. But our commitment level of actually utilizing this resource that they created is a bit on the weak side.
Oh, I don't disagree with you.
So get it on the Gospel Library app and I'll be more impressed. That's what I'm saying.
I think that's a very valid point to take is it's there. Sometimes I feel like some of this stuff is there just to say it's there.
We're so doggone safe. Why don't we have Ensign articles about...
I know.
About stuff like this, about being gay and being a member of the church. Why doesn't Tom Christofferson have a lead Ensign article?
Listen, but
because we're afraid.
But at the same time, I'm sitting here saying, and I know it's at the same time I'm sitting here saying the fact that Tom Christofferson, I'm looking at it from the perspective of baby steps, and I know I'd like it to be taking much much bigger steps. I don't know if the LDS church is ready. And I kind of sit there and go, why aren't you ready? Like,
we're going to be taking baby steps for a century. If we don't just jump in the pool at some point, we're never going to learn how to swim.
I know. And so maybe
we're kind of just always tiptoeing into the water,
And maybe the fact that that's the reason why they, Elder Razman is now on the Utah Coalition for teen suicide. Maybe that's going to help.
Yeah. I hope that we get more out there about that. And maybe someday we'll even admit that there's a connection with, with issues surrounding LGBT.
Brian, I got to lighten it up a little bit, okay?
Are you saying that was heavy?
Yes, it was a little heavy. So I'm going to tell you something. I don't know about you, but this time every four years, I become a world-renowned expert in every single obscure Winter Olympic sport that's out there. My wife and I yesterday were watching mixed curling, and the analysis that I brought to the table was phenomenal. Like, I was feeling like I could get out there and do this stuff, okay? So obviously the Olympics are going on. It's a big deal. It's actually kind of cool for me because they're in South Korea. That's where I served my mission.
So this is how bad I am. I didn't know that it was only every 4 years. That's seriously. That's how like out of the Olympic loop I am.
What kind of American are
you? I didn't realize what kind of an American. This is like the most international.
What kind of member of Earth are you? Earth,
yeah, exactly. What kind of citizen of Earth are you? Honestly, I didn't realize that it only came up as often as presidential elections.
Yeah, well, it's every 4 years, and then the 2 years in between that, then it's the Summer Olympics, and the Summer Olympics are every 4 years. So, anyways, okay. It's a very big deal in the Malone household, Brian. That's what I'm trying to say. Anyways, if you're in Korea, guess what? The Mormon Helping Hand Center offers just about everything a cold and tired Olympic spectator, volunteer, media representative, or even athlete could ask for.
It's like a nice warm towel.
As a matter of fact, they probably do have warm towels because Koreans love that kind of stuff. It's a place to warm up, enjoy a hot beverage, and recharge cell phones. And visitors not rushing to, let's say, a hockey match or a skating competition or curling can even explore their family history and chat with missionaries in a variety of languages. This is something that was put out by the Deseret News. I think it was done in conjunction with the Church News. This is something that LDS Public Affairs in Korea did. And I guess they got really lucky. They were able to get prime real estate to a lot of different things that are going on. And listen, it's something new and innovative. I like it. I think it's a great idea. And especially if they're not being handed.
Unless you're in South Korea where everybody drinks tea and you go up for a hot beverage expecting tea and you're like, where's the tea? I'm sorry, we only have cocoa. But this is way too sweet and sugary for me. What do you have any tea? No, we don't do tea. Why not? That opens up a missionary opportunity right there. Or I'm just here to charge my cell phone. Oh, let's talk about your relationship with Jesus Christ. Anyway. It could be a good thing. It could be a good thing if we don't just like bum rush people with oh, you're going to charge your cell phone here while you're waiting for it to get up to, oh, no, it's at 13% now. It's fine. It's fine. That's all I needed.
I just, you know what? That's people are going to be going in there going, I just got to get it above 21%. So my battery will go red and I'm out of here. I'm good, guys.
Right. Take my cocoa and go.
So speaking of other church things that are going on, Brian, I know that this is something you have been anxiously waiting for. The LDS Church has launched a new YouTube channel. It is a how-to channel. This is from their YouTube page. No matter who you are, how old you are, or what challenges you're facing, simple, practical help from those who have been there can make navigating life's rough patches so much easier. From relationships to finances to parenting and more, let how-to be your one-stop channel for finding the help you need when you need it. So Brian, obviously, the big question is, what how-to subject should the LDS Church tackle when it comes to their new YouTube channel?
I was thinking like re-roofing or like, you know, changing out your gutters or, you know, something really super practical. Like this is the Mormon way to re-roof your shingle house.
the Mormon way. So we're gonna have refreshments afterwards, basically. That's what it is.
Right. We're gonna order some Little Caesar's pizza. We're gonna ask for everybody in the neighborhood to come over and help us out. Right. And then we're gonna stand around on our cell phones for the next 3 hours while everybody else does the work.
And we're gonna be watching them go, yeah, you're doing good up there. Yeah,
that's right. Oh, that's how you do it. That's how
you see, because I was sitting here going, all right, this is the easy joke territory, but I was sitting here going, like the obvious how-to video you have to do is how to do proper Mormon funeral potatoes.
That's good. Or maybe how to properly pack up your house for when the elders quorum comes over to help you move.
I mean, hold on. If that's the case, you're saying that we actually do that. So
no, we do. I thought that was there's a Mormon moving committee, right? Oh,
yeah. Well, maybe that's the reason why we need a how-to. Just to, hey, check out this YouTube video before we come over, and you can see exactly what you need.
Exactly. Yeah. How to label your boxes correctly. How to, you know, all this stuff. How to make sure everything's going to fit in the U-Haul that you rented because you decided to rent a 5 foot less U-Haul than what you actually need to save a little bit of money, and now you're getting all this free labor on top of it. I'm not bitter.
Here you go. Here's one. How to secretly record your LDS bishop's interview.
Ooh.
How is that for a transit?
Oh, that's spicy. I don't think they're going to do that. I don't think, is that even legal?
Oh, let's talk about that, Brian. It's almost like we coordinated this. Go figure. All right. So let's get the details out of the way. Representative Lowry Smith proposed House Bill 330 on February 5th, which would make Utah a two-party consent state to record a personal conversation or telephone call. That's what this whole hubbub is about, if you've heard about it. So right now, Utah is currently a one-party consent state. And I'm not a lawyer, but that means if Brian and I were having a phone call, I would only need one party's consent, for example, my consent, to record our conversation. This bill came under a lot of heat recently because reports started surfacing that the LDS Church was contacting lawmakers and lobbying for this bill.
But wait. So when you say one-party consent, and it can be your own consent, do you have to vocalize that consent? Do you have to literally speak it out and say, I consent to recording myself here? Mentally give yourself consent? Or perhaps prior consent. Maybe that's what it is. You have prior consent.
So you got to speak it out into the ether. Like, before I make this phone call, I consent to myself being recorded. No, you don't have to be on the recording giving consent, from what I understand. It's just me. So here's what started happening, and this is the reason why it made news and the Mormon connections. The LDS Church was contacting different lawmakers, lobbying support for this bill, saying, we really, really support this bill. So Representative Snow said he received a call from the LDS Church with interest in the bill and a possible desire to support the bill. And then the church issued this statement Tuesday backing the measure. Church representatives have spoken with legislators to express support for House Bill 330, which is intended to protect the confidentiality of sensitive private conversations, including those between ecclesiastical leaders and their member. That was from Eric Hawkins, the man at the LDS Church who does not sleep. In other states, business, legal, religious, and law enforcement organizations have supported similar laws to safeguard confidential conversations for the same reasons. Senator Todd Wheeler said it does appear that this original concept was universally hated after lawmakers were inundated with emails and phone calls from constituents saying, we do not support this bill. Representative Snow said he asked the chairman of the House Rules Committee not to move the measure forward for now. It sounds like they are taking a strong break on this based on all that. Former state Senator Steve Urquhart said a legislator told him anonymously, to avoid repercussions, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints had asked for the bill, House Bill 330, because it was upset over, quote, recently released recordings regarding the church, end quote. So, Brian, I think there's a lot to unpack in here.
This is really going to crimp my desire to record the high priest group snoring.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, if there's one thing that we need
if they're unconscious, does it count? I mean,
how can you can't
get you can't get unconscious. You can't get consent if they're unconscious, right?
So there's a lot to unpack here. A, the bill itself, and B, the LDS Church's involvement with it. So let's talk about the bill itself. I am actually in support of that bill. I was in support of that bill before I found out the LDS Church was lobbying for it. Simply for this reason. I understand that recording without people's consent can be very beneficial if you are in a position where you are feeling threatened. So I'm thinking about in an employment situation, in a religious situation, in a marital situation, in lots of different situations, there is benefit of saying, no, I'm recording this because I don't really care what I need to protect myself. From what I understand, there were some provisions and exemptions in the bill, and I've been trying to go through and read the bill. You know what it's like, Brian. It is such fascinating reading to read legislative bills, but I've been trying to read it, and it seems like they are carving out some areas of that, including things like blackmail and assault and things like that.
Real quick. So I actually do have a personal acquaintance who has to record her ex-husband's calls because of the amount of threats that he's left onto her. So in situations like that, I don't think that she can't inform him that he's consenting because she needs to catch him in the act doing this.
Why would it be, and this is an obvious softball question, why would it not be beneficial for her to inform him that she's recording?
Well, I mean, it's just only because they're trying to catch him.
They're trying to catch him. But if she were to tell him, I'm recording this conversation, he's going to react differently, right?
Right.
And I think that's the thing
he's going to check himself and say, well, I'm not going to say anything. It's going to get myself and get me in trouble.
And I think that's the thing that irks me a little bit about some of the recordings that have been released. Because it is, in a perfect world, we all say the correct things at the correct time. But the downside of recording someone and that person not knowing they're being recorded, especially if you're doing it with maybe less than ideal circumstances or less than ideal intents, is that you can begin to say things to get a reaction out of that person. And I think it's a very different conversation and a very different way of going about things if you're doing that with that person's consent, like, just to let you know, I'm recording this conversation. Well, okay, I'm not going to continue this conversation, versus having a conversation and not realizing, wait a minute, all those things that you and I were talking about, you recorded them. And
maybe you were intentionally leading me down a path in order to get the responses that you were looking for.
Right. at the same time, I also sit there and say, I'm one that is starting to be very, I'm very supportive of transparency within the LDS church. And I think that is important sometimes for that transparency because it makes sure that all parties are held accountable. Now, I wonder how that would factor in if, for example, if I had a really, an extremely nasty discussion with a bishop or a stake president, and they said some really nasty things towards me, and then publicly they weren't saying that because they were trying to save face. This hasn't happened, but just go with me on this. I actually wouldn't feel any qualms about recording that. But I think the problem is it's not people who are going through situations like that. It's people who are going through situations mostly, I mean, I'm just going to generalize here, mostly with the intent of making the LDS church look bad. Whether the LDS church is doing that themselves or not in some of those situations, that's a good question and debate to have. But to sit here and this is, I think this is the problem. So the Salt Lake Tribune article that we're going off of quoted John DeLynn. I think this is part of the problem that the LDS church faces sometimes. The LDS church is very quick to go on the defense. They're not very quick to go on the offense. And so John DeLynn was able to get out there, give one of the first quotes saying, this is directly because of the recordings that I'm doing and Jeremy Runnels and all these other people are doing. I think that probably plays a factor. I can't imagine that they like it. But at the same time, now the conversation is about that instead of what we're talking about, which is what are the ethics behind recording a conversation like that?
Right. It distracts. But also, I don't recall John DeLynn himself personally recording any of this stuff. I recall him putting out stuff that was recorded by others. But if he's sitting there trying to take credit for himself, like, you know, I mean, I don't know. It's typical. It's typical. Look at all the stuff that I've done and it's all making changes now. But it's, you know, it's...
And I will say this, Brian, and this is very insider baseball. We also don't know what's been recorded that hasn't been released.
No, that's very true. I think that we can talk a little bit more in the deep cuts about how, you know, what our feelings are around certain parties being involved with this, but let's stick with more the ethical side of this for this portion of the conversation.
So I think that that's kind of where I'm sitting on the issue. So if you're okay, so that handles the issue. The other issue is the LDS church getting involved. And I think that is where I begin to get very nervous about this, mostly because I'm perfectly fine on my personal morals and ethics saying, yeah, I think that Utah should be a two-party consent state. It makes sense to me because of all these different things that we've talked about and misrepresentation. But then when the LDS church starts getting involved, I'll be honest, that's where I was like, gosh, why do you have to do that? Like the business and some of the other reasons that were brought up in the bill itself makes sense. But then the LDS church got involved. And I'll be honest, Brian, my initial impression was like, but you don't have to. And this is just going to tick people off. And why do you have to do this? This wasn't an issue.
So the question I like to ask myself along those lines is, what would the Roman Catholics do? It's a question I often ask myself.
I don't know how well that would go on a bracelet, Brian. WWRC.
RC, yeah. and I think about like, what would an archdiocese in like, say, Boston, right? If an archdiocese was to get involved in this kind of public legislation and working with legislators in a very public way, would I find that irritating? And if I would find that irritating, then maybe I should apply those same standards towards my own faith tradition, right? So in this case, I'm kind of with you. I think that the LDS Church probably would be better off not putting its name on this legislation, not being involved. But, you know, let's be real. Everybody knows that Utah legislation and Utah legislators are heavily tied in with the LDS Church. So even if they didn't have their name publicly with it, I guarantee you that there's conversations that are probably being one consent recorded that will end up being released later on. Documents that will end up being released later on that will once again show that the LDS Church was involved with another piece of legislation. And then it'll just be used to embarrass the LDS Church as opposed to, I mean, at least they're being upfront about their interest in this.
Well, but they were upfront because it came out that they were involved.
It wasn't something that they had put their name on initially. It was only after it hit the press that they said, "Oh yeah, we're talking to them about that."
Because I'm sure that Eric Hawkins just got inundated with press inquiries after it came out, and mostly because John DeLynn was the one who broke the story, released the story, and got a lot of attention on it, and that's where it went from there. But Brian, I think it goes back to another thing, and. This might be a little, I don't want to call it Michigan insecurity, but this might be a little bit of my perspective as a Mormon who is an outsider to Utah. It seems like the LDS Church loves to get involved in Utah politics all the time. And I don't see them getting involved all the time in politics that go on in other states. And I think when that happens, that's where I sit there and go, should you even be getting involved in Utah politics in general? Because that's where I'm sitting there saying, oh, it's in Utah and you can have some influence in
this. Well, and when 70% of legislators are members of the church, it's kind of hard to get away from it.
And considering our culture and how deferential we are to leadership, it does look a little not good. I was going to say slimy. I don't think it's slimy, but it's like...
It's theocratic, Brant. It's theocratic.
Sure. All right. So, Brian, let's move into the top story. The top story this week, I will give a content warning to everyone. We will be talking about abuse, physical abuse in this story, so consider yourselves warned. The top story this week is from Daniel Burke and MJ Lee at CNN, Rob Porter and Mormonism's hashtag MeToo movement. So let me give you some background. Rob Porter, the former chief of staff of Senator Orrin Hatch, resigned as White House staff secretary on Wednesday after allegations surfaced by his two ex-wives that he had abused them. Porter denied the charges. Jennifer Willoughby, Porter's second wife, told the Daily Mail that Porter was abusive and that she was, quote, walking on eggshells, end quote, during their marriage because of his anger. His first wife, Colby Holderness, told the British paper that Porter was, quote, verbally, emotionally, and physically abusive, and that's why I left. Jennifer Willoughby and Colby Holderness said their LDS bishops either didn't believe them or didn't step in to help when they alleged Porter had physically abused them. So some of this is from the Salt Lake Tribune. When I tried to get help, I was counseled to carefully consider how what I said might affect his career, Willoughby wrote in a blog post last year, adding later, friends and clergy didn't believe me, and so I stayed. She also told The Intercept that when she went to her bishop about Porter's anger issues, he cautioned that it could hurt Porter's image. Keep in mind, Rob has career ambitions, she recalled the LDS leader saying, according to the online news outlet. It's difficult to speak to specific circumstances without clear information from all involved, but the position of the church is clear. This is from Eric Hawkins. There is zero tolerance for abuse of any kind. Church leaders are given instruction on how to prevent and report abuse and how to care for those who have been abused. Porter himself has forcefully denied the abuse accusations from two ex-wives, calling them part of a smear campaign. Holderness said Porter emotionally and physically abused her, choked her repeatedly, and in one instance punched her in the face, leaving her with a black eye. And there are pictures of this floating around on the internet. But she said it was hard to talk about her experiences with her bishop, especially with her husband sitting beside her. Eventually, she told three bishops that Porter was, quote, being physical, end quote, she said. She's not sure they understood. She could almost see one wondering, what does that mean, Holderness recalls. It wasn't until she met a professional counselor that she was warned about the gravity of her situation. Quote, it was the first time I had someone say to me, this is very serious. You might not feel like your life is in danger now, but this is very serious. And choking is something that can become life-threatening. The LDS Church Handbook of Instructions does not offer instructions on how to spot spousal abuse, how to discern types of abuse, or how to talk to spouses about it. Brian, this is a major, major story this week.
Even Trump tweeted about it. I mean, he didn't use names, but he said, you know, another man's career ruined because of allegations or whatever nonsense. This is a big story.
So that's something that's been going around, and I could almost see people going, well, now we're in a situation of he said, she said, and I almost sit there and go, you've got two against one. And if you think that this is a mass conspiracy, that these women conspired together because they wanted to stick it to Trump and stick it to Porter, you got to be kidding me.
Especially, I mean, the thing that hurts the worst is the good old boy system that took place. And I mean, so I got a couple of places that I want to go with this, but one of them I think I'm just going to save for the deep cuts, and that's whether or not we should even be going to bishops with major serious marriage issues to begin with. I mean, they're untrained clergy, they're volunteers, and I think that there's been some write-ups that discuss how, you know, how men work so closely together in the church that sometimes there is this kind of good old boy system and this tendency to not believe women when they come forward with these allegations. It's like when women come forward, we're like, oh, she's just hysterical, right? She's just being hysterical. And there's, guys, you failed. You as bishops who, when she came to you, if you were just kind of uh-hawing your way through that interview with her, you failed as a bishop. But on the other hand, again, she probably, you know, she probably could have gone someplace else. I'm glad that she ultimately did. I'm glad that Rob resigned from his position. And I think that some people have been pointing to this as another Mormon Me Too moment. I think it is.
Yeah, well, and I'm thinking about the discussion we had last week when we talked about the process that bishops are supposed to follow. And I'm not sure if abuse falls within this, but again, I'm playing the result. But I would imagine if I was a bishop and I was hearing those things, my first call would be that 1-800 number to discuss with them, like, this is what I'm being told. And I think that obviously the tragic part of this is that all this happened and now we're talking about it after the fact, saying, oh, well, we should do better at this, we should do better at that. And that's where I don't know. I I think LDS people put, I'm trying to be careful about what I say. LDS people put a lot of faith in their bishops for a lot of things. But I think that sometimes what we fail to recognize is that bishops are there as ministers and as spiritual support and spiritual
right. guidance. Well, and also as administrators of the ward, of the programs of the ward too. And that takes up probably 75% of their time. And ministering to individuals for their spiritual health is another, you know, important part of their calling. But they're not there to resolve major marriage issues. But what gets me though, nonetheless, what gets me is, so I read the CNN article on this, and it's a very good article. What gets me is that when she sat down with her leader, and I'm not sure if it was her bishop or it was another ecclesiastical local leader, when she sat down with him, she said, "He's being physical with me." And she said that the guy she was talking to just had kind of a blank look on his face. Like, he didn't get what that meant at all. I'm sorry, anybody who's listening to this who happens to be in any sort of a leadership position where you might hear some sort of confessional stuff from people, whether you're in a stake presidency, whether you're in a local bishopric, if somebody comes up to you, particularly a woman, who says, "He's being physical with me," that's your opportunity to maybe ask a follow-up question, not just sit there blank, you know, staring blankly at her, wondering when she's going to, you know, shut her trap and go away so you can move on to the next, you know, the next interview and issue somebody a calling in the primary.
Just or to what you're saying, sit there and go, "Oh, whoa, yeah. This is uncomfortable. I'm in way too deep." So
yeah,
maybe we'll just move on with this. And if I don't ask any questions, she won't tell me anymore. And we can just.
Right. And particularly with the guy's public profile, right? I mean, we had some downplaying there of saying, well, you know, I mean, he's got a really, really big, important career track. So let's just, oh man, that's ugly. That is so ugly.
And I think what this shows is, well, okay. So going back to actually discussing what's going on with them from, I'm not a professional therapist or counselor. I read a lot of things. And from what I've read, for victims of abuse to actually go to someone and tell them, it is a very, very difficult moment for them.
Yeah. And there's a lot of, and what you said earlier, there's a lot of trust that's put into our bishops to be able to hear these things and to give us some sort of advice and some guidance. And I guess that's really my question for our listeners this week is, do you really think it's a good idea to go to your bishops for serious marital issues? Is that really the first place that you should go? Or should you try to seek more professional counseling up front? What I want to hear from people, if they're okay with it, is some personal experiences that they may share. Do you have a positive experience about going to a bishop who gave you some excellent advice that helped things out? Or on the reverse, do you have a horror story where it just was completely unhelpful at all, where there was just where you really regret having gone to the bishop for some serious help? We want to hear both stories. And if you want to remain anonymous on them, we totally respect that. Just let us know. Don't use my name. We don't want to make anybody feel uncomfortable with it, but you can email us at mail@mormonnewsreport.com, or you can leave us a voicemail at 801-987-0192. Of course, you can always comment on our Facebook page or on our Twitter feed. However, if you want to remain anonymous, then I wouldn't recommend using those. I'd recommend emailing us or calling us. Once again, that's mail@mormonnewsreport.com or a voicemail at 801-987-0192.
And before we wrap on this, Brian, the one thing I did want to say is I think it goes back to what Ty Mansfield was saying, that these stories, the positive and the horror stories, they're important because it helps. You never know who is going to help. There could be someone saying, "I don't know if I should go to my bishop." If someone has a positive story, maybe it helps them. Or someone saying, "Wow, I went through this horrific experience." Hearing somebody else that has gone through that, it helps them. We'd like to welcome onto the show Christina Rossetti. Christina is a doctoral candidate from the Department of Religious Studies at the University of California, Riverside. She completed her bachelor's in liberal studies at Cal State Fullerton and her master's in religious studies at the UC Riverside. Her research focuses on the intersection of Mormonism and spiritualism, with particular attention to alternative forms of Mormon religious practice, which sounds just fascinating. I can't wait to talk with her about that. Her dissertation uses historical and ethnographic methodologies to investigate the extent to which members of the Mormon groups were involved in 19th century spiritualism and how this involvement manifests in the present, which specifically is what we're going to be talking about. She presented her research at the regional meetings of the American Academy of Religion and nationally at the Mormon History Association's annual conference. In 2017, Christina was awarded the Mormon Studies Fellowship at the University of Utah's Tanner Humanities Center. First off, Christina, welcome. Second off, congratulations on getting that award. I know that that's something that the U is really focused on. I think it's awesome that you were able to get it.
Yeah, thank you so much. I'm really excited to be on the show and super excited to have gotten to move to Utah and be at the U right now.
Listen, it's so it shouldn't surprise anyone on the show, but I'm an outsider to Utah. I've grown up in Detroit, Michigan my entire life. And so you got to tell me, do you still get this sense of like wonderment and amazement every time you go to Utah? Like, this place is different and it's kind of interesting, but it's also kind of weird. So am I the only one that experiences that, or do you get that too?
Utah is my favorite place in the world. I tell everyone that I'm living my Deseret dream, and I mean every moment of that. And nowhere else in the world can you find Dirty Diet Coke. And so it's strange. It's my favorite place ever, and I love it dearly.
My wife is a full convert to Dirty Diet Coke. Every time we go to Utah, we get there. I got to say this. So the first time I went out there, I saw things on, get your Coke and get it dirty. And I'm sitting here going, if I hear about a Dirty Diet Coke in Detroit, that means a very different thing. That's usually, you know, Diet Coke with alcohol or Diet Coke with something else. And we go to Utah. No. It's Diet Coke and coconut. I do got to say this though. And obviously there's a different soda wars going on in Utah, but I'm partial to Sodalicious down in Provo, and they have the problem is my in-laws are down in Payson, which is near Provo. And so that's the reason why. And El Doctoro is horchata and Dr. Pepper. And that was the closest thing I've had to coming to heaven. So I'll throw that out there.
I'm team swig. There is a swig in Provo.
Oh, really?
Let it be known that there's a swig in Provo, so there's really no excuses there.
All right. Next time I'm in Utah, I will put Sodalicious and swig to the test.
Okay.
Speaking of being in Utah, Christina's going to be speaking Tuesday, February 20th, at the Carolyn Tanner Irish Humanities Building at 12 p.m. Mountain Time. And she's going to be doing it as part of the Tanner Institute's Work in Progress talk. And listen to this talk. This sounds like fascinating to me. Spectral Authority in Contemporary Mormon Fundamentalism. Now, those are a lot of big words, and we're going to talk a little bit about that. But Christina, I've got to ask, it seems like that is a very niche subject to get into, this whole concept of spiritualism, and not just spiritualism, but spiritualism within 19th century Mormonism, and now this is looking more at contemporary Mormonism, but not just like the LDS church, but fundamentalist groups. Where did you begin to get an interest in this? How did this start?
How did this happen? How did I get here?
Yeah, that's the biggest question.
So I was really interested in 19th century religions, and I took a directed study with my advisor, the woman who became my advisor. She's incredible. And it was on communal utopias. And as part of that, I had to read Rough Stone Rolling, Richard Bushman. And I read that book in 2 days.
Whoa.
I know, it's a weird book. I became captivated by Joseph Smith. It was the most incredible thing I'd ever read. And I just became fascinated by the saints. And then I quickly realized that, you know, Mormons are still, they still exist. They're still here. And I knew that, but I didn't really know anything about them. And so after Rough Stone Rolling, I proceeded to read every book on Mormonism that I could find. And I was really naive. I thought Mormonism's 187 years old. They've had 16 leaders. I can learn this history easily, which so naive, because immediately after I met fundamentalists and I met people from the Community of Christ, and I realized that Mormonism is so much bigger than I thought it was. And I loved all of it. And then right in the middle of that, I discovered spiritualism, and to be totally honest, my crippling fear of death was super into that. And I learned about a group of Mormons that in the 19th century were into spiritualism, the God Beit movement, and M.S. Lyman. And I just had this feeling that, you know, things like that don't die, that doesn't end. There has to be Mormons that are still interested in this. And I found them.
So let me ask you, and we were talking about this before we started recording, what is your connection to the LDS Church? Because I think that plays a factor as well.
None. I've never been a Mormon. I'm actually a Catholic convert. So I knew Mormons growing up. We had Mormon neighbors once. I've never been Mormon. I just have always found it to be such a fascinating religion. And I'm not a historian by training. I'm an ethnographer by training. And so I've spent the last 7 years just hanging out with Mormons, going to Mormon wards on Sunday, going to fundamentalist meetings, going to fundamentalist General Conference and just being part of this world of Mormonism.
Well, and I think that that's such a, I am so glad that the field of Mormon studies is starting to broaden. And you and I had talked about this, and I think I mentioned it on the show a couple of times, because I think that it is so important for Mormons to get that objective outsider viewpoint, because there's a lot of times that the objective outsider can tell us more about ourselves than we can. And that's why I think it was important, because obviously with my connection to the LDS Church, I'm fascinated with all that stuff, right? So you're talking about like Rough Stone Rolling and the God Beyites, and I started thinking about the amazing book Wayward Saints and how important that was. Yeah. And there's so much good stuff out there, but I think it's always interesting that it's like, oh, this is what other people, so I'm not the only weirdo out there that's interested, which is great. But then that also leads to kind of where you're going with your research. So you said that you have been to fundamentalist gatherings. You said you've been to Fundamentalist General Conference, and your talk that you're going to be giving at the Tanner Irish Humanities Building on February 20th is Spectral Authority in Contemporary Mormon Fundamentalism. So help me out here, because I'm not a historian, and I'm an amateur when it comes to religious and Mormon studies. Spectral authority. What do you mean by spectral authority?
Yeah. So one of the things that I'm really interested in is when it's okay to practice spirit communication in Mormonism, because there is a difference between the hundreds of people who have really powerful stories of communicating with their deceased loved ones in the temple and people who communicate with Joseph Smith. Mm. And from those communications, they decide that they now hold the keys to the priesthood. Because so many times people who've had interactions with deceased prophets, they end up garnering authority from that. So I'm in this particular talk, I'm really interested in what it means to get spiritual authority from deceased prophets and spirits, particularly Joseph Smith and a deceased fundamentalist leader, Rulon Allred from the AUB.
So I got the blurb from the Humanities Center, and there's this really interesting push and pull, and you kind of alluded to it in what you were saying. This is what they said. While Mormonism has a long history of individuals interacting with deceased ancestors on the other side of the veil, which is what you talked about, and I'm sure that Mormons have heard lots of different stories, and maybe even it's family stories that are passed down from generations about being in the temple and having some of those interactions. It says, LDS leadership enforces a line between acceptable spirit communication and spectral encounters that lead to apostasy. Fundamentalist groups and individuals seeking spiritual authority outside of traditional LDS channels are usually marked as the latter. And so it sounds like we have this push and pull where it's like we as members of the LDS faith want to retain that connection to the post-mortal world, right? And being able to communicate with ancestors and those that have passed on, the spirits that are there, right? But it seems like we draw that line saying when you start wanting to stake authority claims in there, that's when we say, no, you're going too far. Is that kind of what you're seeing in some of your research?
Yeah, absolutely. And especially because, you know, within Mormon fundamentalism, the priesthood lineage is different than the current LDS church. And those lineages are always, when in terms of spirit communication, the groups that are doing that practice, the spirits will always assert that they have the correct lineage, that the LDS church is the one that's in apostasy. So it's interesting that all the groups are kind of using that label to say each other's priesthood authority is incorrect. But you know, the spirits will always testify to the particular group they're speaking of. And so that's something I'm really interested in. So the lines of what makes something apostate and what doesn't is a secondary interest within my research, especially within Mormonism, where the same ghost is appearing to multiple people. You know, Joseph Smith comes to everyone and gives them the keys to the priesthood.
Right. And that's what I kept thinking about was, you know, at least it within early Mormon history, you've got the death of Joseph Smith and then the succession crisis within the LDS faith. I'm here in the Michigan area. And for us, a big part of our connection to Mormon history is the Strangite movement, which was another, in essence, symptom of this confusion of priesthood lineage and where does it go next. But then you start looking at the fundamentalist off groups and they're even more fascinating. And then, it leads to this a little bit in what you're talking about in the blurb here. But then you also have this rise of individuals who are claiming this authority. And I'm thinking of people like Denver Snuffer. I'm thinking to an extent of someone like Julie Rowe. I don't think Julie Rowe would say that she has received this authority, but there are people that are going to her because of her spectral encounters. And it seems like this is something that within the LDS main LDS group, we're not struggling with, but within other Mormon offshoots, that is something that it seems like there's this, they don't know what to do with it, and they're all going to claim the same thing. But like you said, if Joseph Smith's appearing to everybody and everyone's saying that Joseph Smith was next to him, how do you begin to navigate that?
Yeah. And one of the, as you know, as an ethnographer, one of the things that is really important to me is the idea of suspending my disbelief. Mm. So if someone tells me that they had an encounter with a spectral prophet, you know, I'm not here to question that or to say it's incorrect, but I'm here to explain why that's powerful and meaningful to people. But yeah, so I mean, Joseph is, for fundamentalism at least, you know, Mormon fundamentalism really gets its grounding in 1886 with the 1886 revelation and the eight-hour meeting. Mm-hmm. Lest we forget, Joseph Smith was there. He's the one that introduced John Taylor to Jesus Christ. So, you know, from the beginning, people are talking to Joseph and getting authority from him.
So you mentioned a few times that you're an ethnographer. Just for our audience, what exactly does an ethnographer do? Because you had mentioned that you need to suspend disbelief. So do you go into situations with all these different groups and keep as open a mind as you can and say, okay, what you're telling me, I'm going to accept as this is the way it is. Is that kind of how you approach it when you're studying these groups?
Yeah. So I do a lot of participant observation. So I go to church meetings. I go to people's homes. I go to general conferences, and I just participate to the extent to which I'm allowed. Most groups won't allow me to take a sacrament, for example, which is fine, but to the extent I'm allowed, I'll participate. And I also interview a lot of people. And yeah, I'm not here to make claims on truthfulness and what is true and what's not. And I'm also not here to be converted and to eventually be baptized into any fundamentalist group or any Mormon group. But I'm here to tell their story to the best way I can, and to really try to allow their story to be told with their own voice and with as little of me as possible to it, especially because so many people don't know fundamentalists and don't know their stories and their histories.
So what's been the reaction like? And the reason I ask that is because I know that probably about 10 years ago, Mormons were, and I'm thinking the main LDS group, right? The main LDS church, at least in my area, they were very hesitant if anyone was coming around wanting to do what you're doing. We've got a university close by us, and they would sit there and go, why are you here? What are you going to, I want to know what you're going to write about. And we got to make sure that what you're writing and that I'm going to say everything explicitly clear so that you're not misrepresenting us. So that was about 10 years ago. Now, I think, especially with the Mormon moment, we've become a lot more comfortable with that. And we've become a lot more comfortable because in my mind, in 2012, what happened was people began to take Mormonism seriously. It wasn't just this weird group. We don't have to go through the origin story. We're going to talk about them as a people. But you're talking about groups that usually are not as mainstream. And so how has been their reaction? Are they comfortable with this kind of observation and documentation and reporting or scholarship? Or do they sit there and kind of go through what some members of the LDS church went through, which is a lot of insecurity and I want to make sure you're doing this correctly. What's been your experience?
Yeah, so I work with two specific fundamentalist groups in particular. So I'm not in any way a scholar of all Mormon fundamentalism, but it's two specific groups. And I think in general, the reaction has been fairly positive and welcoming. I was actually invited to the group in Nevada to their gathering place by their leadership. And so that was really incredible and a great opportunity. And then they invited me to general conference and to their meetings. And I think the big thing is building relationships and building friendships with people and building trust that I'm doing the best I can to, you know, present them fairly and accurately. I think the biggest thing is I've always been very supportive of having them work alongside me to present their history. And, you know, I'm not trying to go rogue and write their history without them. And, you know, I'm trying to have a relationship in which they can participate in that. And so I think because of that, it's been fairly welcoming. I haven't had a whole lot of difficulty, but the groups I'm working with are not immensely closed off to outsiders per se. So they are groups that are still allowing converts. It's not, you know, like the FLDS, which hasn't allowed converts for a long time. So they're still welcoming people in. And I think because my goal is to present them as just Mormon people, I think that's something that they're excited about.
Well, And I could totally see that. We were talking before. It sounds like you and Lindsay Hanson Park have known each other and are working together. And it sounds like you and Lindsay are kind of along the same lines, which is not trying to sit here and say, ah, this is where your story's inaccurate, but just here's the story of this group of people, and here's why they're maybe more complex people than you would have thought. And from my perspective, the interesting thing is it's the same respect that we as members of the LDS Church, we wish that we had. And so I respect it. And I think that you guys are doing very interesting work, mostly because there's so many offshoots and they have such fascinating cultures. And this might be the thing that people of the LDS Church get a little uncomfortable about. There's a lot of similarities there. And you got to pay attention to those similarities, right?
And I think especially as an outsider, it's easier to see those similarities because I have never had any kind of preconceived ideas about what a Mormon fundamentalist is. Mm. But I, going to fundamentalist meetings, I hold the same hymn books as I hold in LDS church. We sing the same hymns. We being the group, I'm not a fundamentalist, but the messages are the same. They're using the Book of Mormon. The single most Mormon thing I've ever done in my entire life is can 300 cans of beef in the Nevada gathering place with the most incredible woman. The most incredible fundamentalist women, but that like the most Mormon things I've ever done, I've done with fundamentalists.
Which I love that. I think that's so, I think that's so awesome. I really do. So Christine, one more time, Christine is going to be speaking Tuesday, February 20th at 12 PM Mountain Time at the Carolyn Tanner Irish Humanities Building in the Tanner Institute's Work in Progress talk. Her talk's titled Spectral Authority in Contemporary Mormon Fundamentalism. This is free to the public, everyone. I think this is a fascinating, fascinating topic. I encourage everybody to go, especially because I think it's great. Christina, thank you so much for coming on. Do you have anything coming out in the near future that we can begin to plug? Any articles or other lectures that you're going to be doing?
I don't have anything, any publications coming up right now. I'm going to be presenting something somewhat similar on a panel at Mormon History Association in Boise coming up. And other than that, I'm just working on my dissertation, trying to get that done.
Wonderful. Hey, good, good, good luck with that. I've never done it. I'm probably never going to do a dissertation, but I have heard that it takes years off your life. So good luck.
Awesome. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much for coming on, Christina. And we will be right back after this.
So speaking about scholarship and books and lectures, Greg Coferd Books is pleased to offer a 15% discount to Mormon News Report listeners at their website, gregcoferd.com. All you need to do is enter News Report, that's all one word in all capital letters, into the discount code box at checkout to receive your 15% off. Orders over $50 qualify for free domestic shipping, and local area customers in the Wasatch Front are welcome to stop by the office in Sandy. They're friendly folks. Say hi. Pick up your books. You can avoid shipping altogether. The next scheduled release is Textual Studies of the Doctrine and Covenants, the Plural Marriage Revelation by William V. Smith. This book is coming out on February 27th, and it looks at the history of Joseph Smith's 1843 Plural Marriage Revelation, as well as its deep impact onto Mormonism even up to the current day. This book is now available for pre-order. Just visit gregcoferd.com. That's GREGKOFFORD.com and enter News Report, all capital letters, all one word, to get your 15% discount as a Mormon News Report insider.
And that is our show. This show is brought to you by our friends at the Cultural Hall Podcast. Be sure to check out the rest of the shows available at theculturalhall.com. Guess what, guys? They do articles of news. It's a lot like the Mormon News Report, but they're covering some different articles. They might have some different takes. I recommend you all check it out.
Plus, Jenny's usually over there with them, and she's great. Over there
too, friend of the show.
So we also want to thank all of you who are supporting our show through Patreon, what we call our insiders. You are the reason that we can do this from week to week, and I'm actually not being facetious when I say that. It literally is you guys that's helping us to pay for the software and to record this show each week. So we do truly appreciate your support. If you do want to become a supporter of the show, just visit us on patreon.com/Mormon News Report, where for as little as $1 per month, you'll get an exclusive midweek deep cut where we dig a little deeper into stories. We dive into the rabbit hole that maybe a little bit more than we do during the main show. Who knows? I mean, you might even hear a few swears.
You get the heck out of here, you little fetcher. Okay. I didn't know that we could do that. As always, if you'd like to reach out to us directly, you can email us at mail@mormonnewsreport.com. You want to leave us a voicemail? We've had a couple of those. We're always looking for new voicemails. Call us, 801-987-0192. You're going to call it. It's going to go right to voicemail. I want to hear your hot takes. If the take is hot enough, we'll play it on air next week. We'll be back next week with more news, commentary, and interviews with just a little bit of snark. Until then, we'll talk to you again after a while.